Today, in part four of the series Building a Marriage, the topic is what kind of relationship do we build? Just what does the Bible say regarding commitment between man and wife? How should we picture the marriage relationship? And how do the gospel and marriage align? Here's Pastor Seth.
All right, well, we've been doing our series on marriage, and Chris Anderson has been very gracious to give us some visuals of what this is. We're using Monopoly theme. The first week, we talked about going, you know, I love the community chess, go back three steps. And we talked about there is sometimes when you're married, you have to go back to what are the basics? What are the most important things that should keep me moving on the right direction? Because in our particular culture, for about 50 or 60 years, our culture has really just strayed into all kinds of lesser views about what marriage is. And that sets up either vastly overrated expectations or makes you really critical, on another hand, of your spouse if they're not meeting up to your expectations. So what is marriage? We looked at that week one. Week two, what is the greatest threat to marriage? The greatest threat to marriage is not outside of me, it is me. It is my ego and my pride and myself. We talked about that. And then last week we looked at love. There are two kinds of love I think of. It's the love that gets you to say I do or to propose and for the girl to say yes and get you to the altar. We call that desire love or romantic love or chemistry, all those good fun things, infatuation. But you will never build a marriage just on that. You need something, a different kind of love that's much stronger, much deeper, what we call duty love, which sounds rather unmotivating. But it's the strength of sacrificial love for the sake of another, even if it requires something of me. That's a very different kind of love than just having dinner on the beach, you know, on a wonderful Saturday afternoon before the sun goes down. But that is something that you build over time. When you get married, you're legally married, like everybody else is, even though you've been married like for a minute, as you're presented. But in another sense, while other people who've been married longer hopefully have built something of a marriage, you really have at that point, as a newlywed, you have just a vacant lot. And there are a lot of things you can build on that vacant lot. But if you're assuming that a marriage should be something that you already have because you're married, you are in for some really rough times. Marriage is something that is built. Love is something that is built. And today we're looking at what kind of relationship do we build? And so we're going to dive into this. What does love look like? Duty kind of love, sacrificial love for somebody else. And try to put some specifics on this. Our first 3 months of marriage, as I've told you, was Mindy was much more realistic about marriage than I was. I had some really unrealistic views of marriage. But one of the things that was really sort of striking to me was, as excited as I was to be married and to be married to Mindy at one level, at another level, when I was home, I found myself just being incredibly nitpicky. Now, I was not verbally nitpicky. I mean, just in my head. And about the stupidest of things, like toothpaste. Or a kitchen sink. Or how you put dishes away. Or how long shoes should stay out in the room before they're put back in the closet. Now, as you know, there are no detailed people at the Gatchel home. I am slightly more detailed than Mindy. Now here's what was so paradoxical and ironic to me and confusing to me. I knew that none of those things mattered for anything. And not only did I know those things didn't matter for anything, I told her, don't worry about that stuff. We were newlyweds. We were doing student ministry at Texas Christian University. We were trying to win the world for Christ. And we were just diving into this thing. And so on the scale of things, these were just stupid things. And yet what was so confusing to me was how come these little things bothered me like they did? And I found my mind just sort of just picking, and I wouldn't say anything. But over a couple of weeks, unbeknownst to me, sort of that picky thing began to affect my attitude. And being a woman, she picked up on this with all the feminine radar that is there. And then she had to drag out of me all of what was going on. And so I finally sort of told her about my things. And she said, oh, well, that's good. You know, I'll work on those things. And I was thinking, oh. Now, we're 3 weeks in. We are 3 weeks into this thing. Well, the next day, I thought that because we'd had this discussion, that all of life was going to be different. And guess what? It wasn't. Which was even more confusing to me, because I thought we had talked about this only yesterday, and there were just a lot of little stupid things that just kept going on. And I found myself going right back to my little nitpicky question. And it's not even that I wanted to do that. It was just like I couldn't almost help but do that. I just found myself doing that. And so I was fighting that inside. And after a couple of weeks, she picked up with the radar that something is wrong. And we had at week number 6 the same discussion we'd had at week number 3. We had the same discussion at week 9 that we'd had at week 6 and week 3. And we had the same discussion at week 12 that we had at week 9, and we had at week 6, and we had at week 3. Except week 12 was different. As we were talking about it, I'm giving you the very short version of this, but after hearing all of this again, she said some very poignant words to me. She said, Seth, I know it may not seem like it to you, but I really am trying to work on these things. But I don't think you're really going to be at peace unless you decide to accept me just the way I am, even if I never change. Now, this was different. Unfortunately, I heard there were two things that went through my mind, and unfortunately, they went through my mind in this order. The first thing was the realization that, wow, these things really may never change, and never is a long time. Some reality struck this boy. But the second thing that struck me was I suddenly remembered my marriage vows. And just 3 months before, I had promised to marry her absolutely, realistically, where she wouldn't have to, you know, watch what she did, all that kind of stuff in order for me to love her, and sacrificially. Well, I'd done the sacrificial part pretty good, but the realistic part, I had fallen flat on my face. And I had a picture of running track in high school and going around the curb and tripping over somebody's foot and going face forward and hands into that cinder. That was the image I had at that moment of what kind of husband I had been. Now, up until that moment, I thought I'd been a great runner, kind of like our video. Until then, and then at that moment, when I realized instead of loving her, I had sort of pinpricked her to death by 1,000 pinpricks. Sort of death by Chinese water torture. And for the first time in 3 months, I could see the effect on her of how painful it was to live with someone walking around with their little fine-tooth comb, their little magnifying glass, looking for all the stupidest of things that aren't going right. I knew what that was like to live because in some ways of my growing up years. This was not new. I could see tears in her eyes. Didn't take long for tears to be in my eyes. Partly because of the pain I had inflicted upon her, and partly because of just the abject sense of failure as a husband that I had at that moment. And we had a good moment there. I asked God's forgiveness and I asked her forgiveness. And I pledged to her that I was going to accept her. And that it was obvious to me that I had failed at this, but that I was going to do this. And this was going to be a high priority item. And I was going to give it my top notch level best to finally get to a place where this thing going on in my head was finally put to death. Now, it took me a year to do that. A year of day by day, concentrated effort, to change me in terms of accepting her. Now, that's something of what we're going to talk about today. When you say building friendship in Christ, I'm not talking about the kind of friendship where you have, oh, we just enjoy each other's company, we love each other as friends, and we're for each other all the time. There's a place for that. That's good stuff. But there's a different kind of friendship that Christ has with us, that though he does love us unconditionally, that friendship does not leave us as we are. He is all about changing us at the same time that he's our friend and that he loves us. There's something of that that we're going to see that is a part of what marriage is. I've broken it down into several things. The first is friendship as in loyalist. Now, if you're an English teacher, you've been an English teacher, you're going to see that that's a misspelling of loyal. Loyalist has an I in it, but not in Gatcha world. In Gatcha world, I feel free to coin my own terms, of which I have done here. And this is the loyalist of friends. Why didn't you say the loyalist of friends? Because I just wanted to make this memorable in some way. In the book of Genesis, seven times when God's creating the world, he looks back and he says, as good. 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 Next time, as good. As good. Except for after he made Adam, he said, that's not good. Now, all you ladies, if you'd been there, you would say, that's right. Yeah, not good. So what does God do? It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. Now, that word helper in the English is just a terrible translation. It's a terrible translation because we really don't have a good English word for this Hebrew word, which is the Hebrew word ezer, E-Z-E-R. Helper sounds like aide or administrative assistant or, you know, something like that. That's not what this is. The word in the Hebrew means a helper companion. It's somebody who comes along next to the general or to the president and makes sure through his ability or her abilities to get what needs to be done, accomplished. Because left to himself, he's not going to be able to do that. We've looked at the importance of gender back in week one. We're going to look at this in a couple of weeks again. But the idea here is it's not just anybody will do of any gender. There is something distinctly different about male and female that when put together brings completion. So if this is new for you, hang on for a couple of weeks. We'll develop this more in a few weeks. But you can think of it like this. If Adam was a violin, the ezer is the bow. Two violins are not going to really help the violin player. If you're going to have a Thanksgiving dinner at your house and a party and you need a big round table, you want everybody to sit around. If you only had half of a table, semicircle of a table, you're halfway home. If you add another semicircle to that circle, you've got a round table and you can have your meal there. But that's not what an ezer is. An ezer is something like this. Adam was the table legs that you're going to have your Thanksgiving dinner on. But something is missing if we just have table legs. We need a table top. An ezer is the table top. Nobody's going to sit around at my house on Thanksgiving Day eating their turkey on the couch looking at such wonderful table legs there in our living room floor. They're just magnificent. Oh, that we only had a tabletop. And nobody's going to sit around on this wonderfully glass-polished tabletop that you might have at your house that's sitting on the wood floor, laying on the wood floor at home, as sitting around it with your pumpkin pie and whipped cream going, isn't this just a lovely tabletop? But if you mix the legs along with the tabletop, you're going to have, depending on the people you have at your table, a delightful time around that. That's something of what an ezer is. There's something that's distinctively different that the other person doesn't have that when put together There's something magical that happens. Now, in one sense, one of the applications of this is a certain kind of relationship that that I think of as a certain kind of friendship. Proverbs 17:17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." This is more than just friends who just like to hang out. We like the same things, and you know, but we really don't get in each other's business. When we were, again, first married, the thing that I had to ask Mindy's forgiveness for more than anything else was being harsh. As a lot of you know, when I was younger, I had a horrific temper in college. And I became a Christian my junior year in college. And God has been, you know, been working on that over the years. I was 26 when we got married, so I had a little bit in the bank. But, you know, marriage kind of brings out some of the ugliness inside of you. And one day, I got really mad at Mindy for something during our first year of marriage. And for some reason, I thought it a good thing to go on a rant. I don't know why that made sense to me, but it did. And so I went on my little rant. And when I got done, the first thing that I thought of was, "Oh, that's really good. Yeah, yeah." Now she sees the worst of you she's ever seen in all the years that you all have known each other. And I had just a thought of, it was so bad, I thought, I wonder if she'll stay with me. Now, I didn't really wonder that because I knew she was going to stay, not because of the character of her husband, but because of her character. So it really wasn't a question of if she would stay. But this verse does come to mind. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. I had just provided some adversity for her, and she is building the muscles of a certain kind of friendship that is loyal, no matter what the spouse puts in front of them. Proverbs 18:24, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." My pastor in Texas used the image of he said, "A good wife is the woman on the captain's wife on the Titanic who would have been standing next to the captain on the bridge, her arm tucked in his, singing, 'Nearer, my God, to thee,' as the ship headed into the North Atlantic." As opposed to, "Didn't you see this coming long ago? Why didn't you do something about this? And am I going to let this go?" Etc. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. This is what she did at our 3-month thing. She didn't say, "Seth, you promised to love me and accept me and to love me realistically and absolutely, and you just have failed to do that." She didn't say that. She could have said that. Listen again to what she said. She said, "I don't think you're going to have peace until you decide to accept me just the way I am." You catch the difference? The first one would have been about her. Even in her pain, the second one was she was trying to make this, help me to take responsibility for me, to step up and be a man. Not without a, you know, "Hope you do better," but encouragement. There's a certain kind of friendship there. Now, this kind of friendship doesn't just miraculously happen. It is usually born out of conversations like this and those episodes when you are at a crossroads of how you're going to respond. And how you're going to respond is either to make me feel better right now and to get something off my chest or just be honest, or to think about what is it I can say to my friend that might help them move forward. That's something that you build. Now, the second kind of relationship is the grittiest, and I believe that is a word, the grittiest lover, although lover should be in quotation marks. Because in our culture, lover means romantic love, chemistry, passionate love, and sexual relationship, and certainly that's true. But as we looked at last week, if you are building your marriage on the hopes of romantic love, chemistry, passionate love, and great sex, good luck with that. That kind of love just isn't strong enough to deal with all the many different responsibilities of marriage. 1 John 3 says, "Dear friends, now we are children of God. What we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure." Now, what he's saying is that in the process of life, whether you're married or not, you can expect that God, if you're one of his kids, is going to be working in you to build Christ-likeness in you. And when he talks about purity here, he's talking about not just sexual purity, but he's talking about the taking out of my pride and putting humility in its place for the ability of loving like Jesus does. Now, marriage is one of these things where this happens in spades, because there really is no other relationship where the worst side of you finds its way out. It took me about a year before I realized, I think she has seen the worst about me now, at least the worst that I know of. There may be parts that I haven't seen yet of myself, but it took about a year. Now, through the course of this, on the inside of your handout, we have sort of this other kind of relationship that we're to emulate in how Jesus relates to us. And here's this is where friend and love are sort of mixed together as Jesus talks about his relationship with us. Friend, love. Friend, love. John 15:9. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. That's to be my model. How does God love me? He loves me in spite of all my weaknesses. He loves me in spite of all my sin. In fact, at any given moment, those things are the farthest thing from his mind. The most important thing to his mind is he really enjoys it when I'm in his presence. And if I can get a picture of that and then relate to my spouse like that, we're going to be building something different here. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Remain in my love. Verse 10, if you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. In other words, we're not just sort of coasting along. I just have to be me. No, that's a bad idea for me, just to remain me. Amen. That's right. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you. All of this struggle and dealing with the flesh and dealing with my own sin and my own pride is for everybody's benefit, including mine and including my wife's. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. It is a complete and full love, but it's also a love that's not content to leave me as I am. It's going to relate to me in such a way, it's going to be nudging me forward to be more like him. Greater love has no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. You hear the love, sacrifice, friend kind of woven through here. You are my friends if you do what I command. This is not just an unconditional friendship. It's a friendship moving in the same direction of becoming like Christ. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Said, I've called you friends, for everything I learned from my Father I have made known to you. We sang this song. It's one of Mindy's favorite songs, one of my favorite songs, just a few minutes ago. I am a friend of God. That's not just a nice theological song for us to sing. That's a reality. That's how God thinks of you, if Jesus Christ lives in you. Those are the glasses he's wearing as he looks at you. That you are his friend. I was talking to a pastor friend of mine when we were away, and I was asking him about how it's going, and the short version here is he has something of which he's carried around with him for a long time that brings him shame. It's easy for him to sort of let that come right out there and to be reminded of that over and over and over again. That's not necessary. The loyalest of friends, the grittiest of lovers, and the third one, and you're going to have to hang with me on this one because this is going to need a lot of explanation. A committed midwife. Committed midwife. Seth, I think you've had too much coffee. Maybe too many chocolate chip cookies. That may be true. I think I set a record in Fort Worth. Way too many. Now, Galatians 4, Paul used this metaphor that I'm going to borrow for this particular thing here. Galatians 4:19, he's talking to the Galatians, folks who had become Christians in this whole area of modern-day Turkey, and he's sending a letter to the whole region there, and he says, my dear children, for whom I am again in the pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. Now, there's a metaphor, a picture, an image that he's giving to these people, And it's a familiar image. If you've had children, you have that day when you go to the hospital and the child has been inside of mom for 9 months. The conception has started, but it takes a while, the gestation period, until the times of birth. And there's this awful hours of the birth when the child is finally birthed. And you can see the birth of the child, and we exult over that. We joy over that. Now, he's using the same image to describe sort of what he's doing. He says it's almost like the conception with you in the Galatians church was when Christ came into your life as your Savior. That's great. But from that moment on until now, I have been working and praying for you guys, some of you knuckleheads, all these months, hoping that the time when Christ can be seen in you will happen. Now, that imagery is also a good image for husbands and wives. It doesn't take long after you're married to realize, ladies, that you, though you married, you may have married what you thought was Mr. Hunk when you got married. Actually, what you married was a block of granite. And what you're going to realize is it's going to need a lot of chiseling over time. And you can tell that God's going to be working in your husband's life, but sometimes he's going to put the chisel in your hands. There are other times when you dare not touch that chisel and let God be the chiseler. In the same sense, guys, when you married, you may have married your divine princess, you know, the queen, you know. And then after a few months of marriage, you realize that there's a whole lot more to this picture than you thought. You thought you were marrying this beautiful garden, front yard, flowers and bushes and stuff. And after a few months of marriage, you realize there's a backyard back there. And it doesn't look like the gardener's been there for a long time. Yeah, we need a gardener. And sometimes God is going to be the gardener. And sometimes he's going to put a shovel or some little snips in your hands as the husband. Now, how to do this is pretty tricky, and we're going to talk about this next week. But the idea is we're not just here as husband and wife just to love each other and accept each other for who we are, period. Marriage is much more than that. God is at work through you as a husband in the shaping of your wife, and through you as a wife in the shaping of your husband. Ephesians brings this out. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her to make her holy. And here's these two metaphors going together of Christ's work and the comparison of marriage. Cleansing her by the washing of water with the word to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any such blemish, holy and blameless. There are times in your marriage where a lot of times where it's important to accept your spouse, period. We'll talk about that next week. There are other times when we are called upon to speak truth to our spouse. Now, how you do that, we'll talk about next week. But it's more than just getting along and hoping you're happy with me. One of my mentors, Larry Crabb, was speaking years ago at a big conference, and he and his wife, Rachel, were at a hotel, and he was getting ready. And as is often the case, you sort of wish I had one more hour I could go over my notes and review this and have it more tightly in my head. And he was at one of those times. I wish I had one more hour than he did. He had about 1 hour to go. He could have used two in the hotel room. And he said, Rachel, if anybody calls, this is before cell phones, if anybody calls, if anything comes up, Just tell them, we have to wait till the talk is done. Not 5 minutes passed when the hotel room phone called. The phone rang, and Rachel picked it up, and it was their son. They have two sons, and one of them was going through a rough patch in his life as a young adult in college. And she talked to him for just a moment, just a brief moment, and then she put the phone down, and she said, Larry, it's for you. It's kept. Now, 5 minutes before, he had asked her not to have any interruptions, no matter what. What was going on with her that she thought that was important for her to not go by those words and to do something different. Now, I'll give you her very short thinking. What Larry saw of himself was, I'm a fairly competent speaker, but I'm not going to really be that competent unless I really have all my ducks in a row. And there's something of truth to that. But also, I'm really not sure if I can handle a crisis on the spot. Every man has that fear, whether he's aware of it or not. Now, why did Rachel give him the phone? The biggest reason she gave him the phone was she wanted to tell him, by how she was relating to him, this. I think you're a big enough man to handle any crisis if you will just give yourself to it. Now, she didn't lecture him. She didn't tell him that. She just related in that way. Now, she paid a little bit of a price for it because he didn't understand why she was doing what she did, and he was a little bit irritated. But when he got off the phone, after having a good conversation with his son and a needed conversation, he saw what she had done and the risk she had taken to herself to move him forward in his relationship with God and with his son, with their son. The last thing I want to mention in terms of kind of relationship, the highest vertical picture, this is the highest vertical picture we have of our relationship with God, is to be seen by our top horizontal priority, how we relate to our spouse. There's something that the world sees and that my spouse is to see about how God relates to me as I relate to my spouse and vice versa. Now, if that's not a part of week number one in how you think about marriage, if you built a marriage on chemistry and romance and the sexual relationship and just the love that we have for each other, what you're going to find not too far into your marriage is a certain amount of restlessness. And the world will give you all kinds of opportunities to fill in that restlessness. And there are some ways that you'll be tempted to fill in that restlessness in really bad, destructive ways. And there'll be other ways that the world will tempt you to fill in that restlessness with what we call good things, like children or making a living, etc. Genesis 2:24 says, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, they will become one flesh. Now, this isn't so much true in our world today, but in countless cultures through human history, this would have been a shocking statement. Because in most cultures around the world, the highest loyalty is to your parents even after you get married. In this Hebrew culture, at the very beginning, when God says to this, he says, that's not how it's supposed to be. There's a higher priority here, even above the loyalty to your parents, and that is loyalty to your husband and wife. The principle is simply this. There is no higher priority of relationship than you are to have with your spouse, not even to your kids. And there is no higher endeavor, even making a living, than the relationship with your spouse. To violate this begins to put your marriage on a downward slope. It may not be seen for many years. But you'll hear things like when guys are talking, all she thinks about is the kids. My needs just seem to be irrelevant. Or you'll hear ladies talking, and you say, all he cares about is his career. He's gone all the time. He just talks. That's what excites him. Sometimes it feels like I'm just a maid and a mistress and a mom. Those kinds of statements. The highest priority is your spouse. Now, that's not popular in our culture today, but it's important. On the back of your handout, the last thing I want to mention today is that there's this interplay in Ephesians 5 between the gospel and marriage. These two images that go back and forth, Paul interweaves these two. And they really have to do, again, with the kind of relationship that we're trying to build, the kind of friendship that we're kind of trying to build. The gospel tells me that I don't have to have it all together. That's one of the things I enjoy about our church. I don't have it all together. Those of you that have known me a long time, you know I don't have it all together. And I feel, as time goes on, I feel less and less the need to try to have it all together. I'll never have it all together. That's not the point. The point is, I don't have it all together, but God loves people who don't have it all together and will just acknowledge that. And I can enjoy that kind of relationship and friendship. Gospel also offers me a fresh start at every moment of my life. What would it be like to relate to my spouse with those two things? Where she doesn't have to have it all together, or he doesn't have to have it all together, or she doesn't have to have it all together, or he doesn't have to have it. What would it be like to be like that? What would it be like to give my spouse a fresh start every time they screw something up, however little or big? Sometimes when I hear couples talk about intimacy, I hear them talk about, oh, we're just never going to have the kind of intimacy because the assumption is we can only be innocent based on our strengths, and those seem to have evaporated long ago. That's not how intimacy grows. Intimacy is the opposite of that. Intimacy grows the longer that my wife sees the screw-up that I am and still embraces me. And the longer I see her screw-ups and she understands and realizes that I still embrace her in spite of all that. It's very real about each other's weaknesses. Very real about each other, humble about how we've hurt each other. And yet those things are not going to identify the nature of our relationship. The nature of our relationship is one of grace. It's the gospel. That's the bottom line. That's the kind of relationship on which you can build something strong that can go through even the worst of times. When my dad was a young husband, he was working for Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, back in the days when Fred just had a little show in Pittsburgh, and my dad was the fundraiser for the show and also the guy in charge of music. I never asked him if he did the Won't You Be My Neighbor song. I never did ask him that. But then I came along, and my sister came along 11 months later, and there just wasn't enough money at that time at the Mr. Rogers show in Pittsburgh to support the family, and so my dad got into life insurance. He became over-the-top successful over the course of his years. And he did what so many men do. There was a shift that went on in his heart. It was something along this line, and it happened without him even knowing it, ever knowing that it happened, until 25 years later he saw the effects of this, then he saw it. This was the world of success where he felt important and valued and where he was doing something and making a difference. And when my mom would say, we just don't spend time together like we used to, he would say, but I work hard and I'm providing for you and for the kids, and what more do you want from me? And no matter how much she tried to explain that, this was not going to penetrate. He violated this last thing, the highest priority. My mother did what so many women do. She saw her dream of the kind of relationship she was going to have with her husband slowly die, and she threw all her emotional eggs in the basket of her children. She experienced connection and acceptance and joy and delight, which is easy to do when your kids are little, up until about fourth grade, and then about fifth grade, if you've had kids, as they're moving into pre-adolescence and adolescence. It's a little bit different boat we're in now than we used to be. I was the oldest. I left for college. My sister left a year later. My little brother's 4 years younger. And when he left the home, my mother's life fell to pieces. Her reason for existence, essentially, was gone. Now, both of my mom and dad, at that point, to their credit, saw what they'd each done. They had left God. He was somewhere down the totem pole of priorities. We went to church every day. I mean, every Sunday. But he was not first. And then next in line, husband and wife were not next. And they repented of both those things. They got their lives straightened out with Jesus, letting him be first in their life, and the person, the one that can fill the Easter egg baskets of our heart. And then out of that, they began to rebuild their marriage. They had about 5 years together before he died. It's really cool to see. They built something in those 5 years. After 25 years of living in a tent on a vacant lot with a lot of money. Let's pray together. Father, it is so easy just to follow after our own pride and ego and how we think things ought to be, and just to make a mess of things over time. And perhaps this is a good time for us to come back to square one and to say, would you take this thing I call self, and where there is pride, would you help me to kill it? It needs a good burial today. And in its place, would you put some humility and some genuine other-centeredness and love, and to be caught up more with reflecting the wonder of grace to my wife or husband than, or to my friends than I am about what I'm going to get. Give us a vision of the kind of relationship that you want us to build. The grittiest of lovers, the loyalest of friends, the person who's willing to take a sacrifice to help build Christ, the highest of priority in our horizontal relationship.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.